right, we are live. Jamie, thanks for joining us. So we are all here for Marketing Mondays, Rev Genius. So we have Jamie Hagan. Did I say that right?
Correct, yep.
Awesome. So Director of Marketing at Selligence. Welcome, Jamie.
No, it's great to be here. I've been listening in for the last few months, so it's fantastic to be on the other end.
Awesome. Where are you out of?
Cardiff. So if typically when we speak to people in the US, they gauge where somewhere is in the country based on how far it is from London. So it's about 2.5 hours on the train from London.
Got it. Awesome. All right. Well, cool. Topic today is building a scalable content marketing strategy, which having spent the bulk of my career as heads of marketing, you know, growth, demand gen, partnerships, is a topic near and dear to my heart, especially given what's going on right now, where all the easy buttons seems to have broken all at once. I'm not sure how effective those EV buttons ever were, but so to a very large degree, it's sort of back to basics and doing the stuff that we ought to have been doing kind of from start. And, you know, I'm a firm believer content has always been king. So let's hop into it. First off, tell us a little bit about Selligence, what you do over there, and then we'll get into the topic for today.
Brilliant. So Selligence, is obviously, as the name suggests, is a sales intelligence platform built off the back of AI-driven sales triggers. So what I mean by a sales trigger is an event that basically suggests that a business might be going through a buying phase. So I think the most well-known example would be a funding round, which is in recent times has probably become a bit oversaturized, but funding rounds is a good example. Company X goes through funding round, they're very likely to be spending money. So we track around 116 different sales triggers, each with some subtypes as well, which means basically thousands of leads that are pre-intent. So it suggests that a business will be looking for your product or solution in the coming months rather than they're actively looking. So you can get ahead of the pack, ahead of the competition. And I think Selligence in its sort of current state is maybe a couple of years old. Previously, we focused on the staffing and recruiting market, but now very much solely focused on the sales industry.
Awesome. And I love how you pointed out there that they are pre-intent. So obviously, if they're pre-intent, you've got a little bit of ways to go around, you know, nurturing them, getting them ready for that conversation, hopefully getting them to a place where they have intent, which, of course, aligns with the topic. It's always interesting to me whenever people start playing around with these types of signals and, you know, how to leverage it. There's almost always like some really kind of interesting, odd, whatever, you know, ways that people have been able to effectively leverage it or insights they've gained out of it. So I imagine with your guys' customer user base that you're privy to at least some of those. Any that are particularly interesting or fun that you want to share?
I think, like I said, we're tracking 116. So there's any one of them I could go through. I think one of our sort of more recent additions, perhaps something that's been, I don't know if you want to say fashionable in recent times, is perhaps, key market movers. So senior leaders and executive leaders, typically when they move from one company to the other, I think research suggests that they spend around 70% of their budget in the first 100 days. So by tracking that particular event, if you've got a company that you're going after and you set a safe search or you set a trigger for that and a new executive joins that company, it's a very, very good way to get your foot in the door and potentially pitch. And that's just one of 116, as I said. I think we're delivering anywhere up to 35,000 leads on average per month across all of our core industries. And as we look to expand those core industries, that figure will go up. So it's a steady stream of leads off the back of these event triggers that basically automate your prospecting.
That's amazing. I knew the tactic. I did not know the stat for how much budget was spent within that period of time. But of course, that makes sense. Like, you're not bringing in somebody new to just do the same thing that was being done before. And so, you know, one, you've got, you know, a mandate around the hiring to come and do things differently or better. But two, like most of us are going to be pretty antsy to get in there and deliver some results and some changes around that. So, you know, makes huge amount of sense on why that would be such a valuable, you know, not necessarily intent signal, but pre-intent signal for that. So, you know, two of the biggest challenges that I've had and, you know, with my teams and running content strategies is content, of course, is a relatively time intensive process to create. And so it can be relatively time resource intensive around that. And so you want to make sure you're doing that as efficiently as possible and also that you're creating the right content for the right use cases. And then, of course, your content's only as good as your distribution strategy and how effective you are at getting that out in front of people, and in particular, in front of the right people, and even better if you can do it at the right time. So what insights do you have around kind of those critical pieces of it? Because you can have the best signaling in the world, but if you're not doing things efficiently and you're not getting it out the door and in front of them properly, then it ain't going to do you a whole lot of good.
Yeah, no. I think on that sort of topic, I think the main note that I made was all around the podcast, and the reason I bring up the podcast, or you know, any one of the podcasts that a company might choose to do, is that by creating a podcast, we're basically fueling our engine constantly every single week. We get the episode of the podcast, which we release every single week, so we get an episode every week. That gets then shared onto Spotify, to Apple, to Google, to Amazon, etc. We get a full episode on YouTube. We clip it up. Those go into YouTube Shorts. They also go onto LinkedIn. We then have text-based posts. If the podcast episode warrants a long written piece, we are able to share that with a content writer. And we're also going to get that on the website. So by producing one podcast episode every single week, we're actually getting 10 to 50 different pieces of content a week, which means we can very efficiently distribute content at mass in a very ordered and structured way just by adhering to that one per week podcast. So I think that's been one of the most, I would say, efficient, or one of the most rewarding or valuable things that we've actually started. I think we started that back in November, so we're coming up to our 20th episode on that, and 20 weeks worth of content and hundreds of sub pieces of content off the back of that. So I think that's been probably the most efficient form of creation and distribution that we've actually started.
That's amazing. I mean, it goes hand in hand with what I tell my teams. If we're ever creating a piece of content that has a single use or a single thing that we're going to do with it, like, we should be really concerned. We need to be figuring out, okay, how's this going to pull double, triple duty? How can we repurpose, reuse the content, slice and dice it, repackage it, whatever. So you get as much mileage out of that content as humanly possible. Because the creation of it is the hardest part, it's the heaviest lift. So make sure you do everything you can as far as getting it out and getting it distributed and finding all the different ways. What's been one of your more effective strategies in driving, So of course, one of the keys in a content, content engine, especially when it comes to distribution of it, is kind of getting things up to a critical mass as far as like people that have awareness and are seeing it, engaging with it. So you get that flywheel spinning, and once you've got it spinning, it takes a whole lot less effort to keep that going. What have been some of the more effective ways that you've had or used to get it to that initial scale, that initial critical mass, as well as, are there, tweaks to that strategy or ways that you, as you transition into that maintenance sort of, flywheel piece of it?
See, I would say, open and honest, that we're very much still in that build stage. So I think in terms of that new strategy that we adopted, we're looking at end of Q3, Q4. So we're very much in that scale up, phase to try and reach, like you said, that flywheel where it's essentially humming nicely and you just have to keep feeding it. So I think the positive signals that we've seen, probably the most positive signals I would say, are off the back of the clips. We produce the podcast, which sits on the website and sits on YouTube, but the clips you know, we're getting thousands of views of the on LinkedIn, and even organically, I'm not even talking about paid here, organically on YouTube, I think we posted clips last week from Outbound 2.0, and there one of them's 1,000 views, and we only shared it last week as a YouTube short. So I think those short and sweet clips have been probably the most rewarding in terms of that. I don't want to say easy, because obviously there's a lot of effort that goes into editing, clipping them up, writing the post. You know, it's labor intensive, but they've been the most rewarding. And I think just naturally that sort of fits with the way people want to consume content, right? Natively inside the platform in a way that requires zero clicks. And that's definitely been the most rewarding for us.
Yeah, absolutely. You definitely want to present your content within, wherever possible, the context of the channel that they've discovered it in. So if you require them to go elsewhere, do something else, go into a different platform, like you're gonna, it's the classic marketer's, problem. Every click, every step, whatever, you're gonna lose a certain percentage of people. So minimize those, keep it as familiar as possible. But also you alluded to something in there that's really important. You design your content relative to kind of where they are in that process or journey or familiarity. And so, for people that are just at that like awareness stage, of course, something that's going to be smaller, more bite-sized, easier to consume is going to be more appealing, and it makes sense that that's going to be what they're going to typically engage with. And so I think that's a piece that, a lot of people miss out on. It's like, okay, yeah, we need to do this in different formats and links and stuff like that. But then how do you best get that in front of the right people relative to kind of where they are and what their needs are, relative to the format, type of content that you've got?
Awesome. Yeah, I was going to say, that I'm a huge believer myself in, I think you've got to get the fundamentals right. And by fundamentals, I mean, again, without paid. So if you're able to consistently distribute at scale, post daily, get it on YouTube weekly, get it on, LinkedIn, get it on YouTube Shorts, your website, all that. If you're able to do that consistently at scale for 3 months, and then you can do it for 6 months, then it's time to start putting some money behind it. If you, like you said, it's that consistency of scaling up to that opportune mass. And I think as soon as you lose that momentum reaching, getting to that opportune mass, then obviously money's just going down the drain on content that people aren't, there's no consistency behind it.
Absolutely. Could not agree more. In fact, I had this conversation with a prospect for us at Rev Genius last week, where they were talking about coming and sponsoring, some content with us, running, some webinars and stuff, and, started digging into it. And it was like, oh, so you've never run one of these internally. I was like, do you know what your process would be, what your, what your operations looks like post event? I was like, no, we were going to figure that. I was like, don't come pay us to go figure this stuff out. It's like, no, like, you need to go run 2-3 of these internally, like, work the kinks out of it, figure out what you need to dial in, fix all of that stuff. Then let's talk. But yeah, you don't want to start throwing money at something only to learn where you've got the giant holes you need to go plug. Like, go test run it, go do dry runs, and then start adding some paid layers to it.
Ultimately, people are under even more pressure in the current climate to get results fast. And I think, 6 months ago, a year ago, podcasting might have seemed like a nice to have rather than a must have. And I think more and more now people are under pressure and they're thinking, geez, I wish we started something 6 months ago, whether it's a podcast or not, whether it's a series of or whatever. But I think, like you said, they're coming to the table thinking, right, we want to do that, but they don't understand. The podcasting distribution, my post-production to-do list, I call it, is honestly about 35 steps. And each step might just be record podcast, could be one step, but it's like a 35 step process that I have to go through for each and every one. And I think if you said that to the majority of people before starting a podcast, they'd say, right, so 10 episodes is going to be 350 actions, and they're just not going to do it, are they? But once they get to that point of understanding the fundamentals, that's the time to really put your money behind it.
Yeah, I mean, we're a similar story here. Our operational doc for spinning up, promoting, running, post event for things like this is about 6 pages long. We're working on trying to whittle that down so it's closer to three. But even then, like, that's a lot of steps. Mm-hmm. Like, there's a lot that goes into doing this stuff and doing it well or doing it right. And I think that's also a big piece of the puzzle. Like, how do you get that as efficient as humanly possible? Because whenever you're having to do this rinse and repeat, then it can add up a lot. You really, really hit on something. And when I've run my demand gen marketing agencies, it's something that I learned the hard way, that you've got to really, really impress on people, make sure they understand. If you're doing a content strategy, it takes time for this stuff to deliver results, especially anything that's going to move the needle. I typically tell them, like, earliest you're going to see anything that's going to start moving the needle is like 90 days. Realistically, you're probably 6+ months out. Have you guys seen similar on your side?
Yeah, I was just going to say, like, it's very much a case of, like I said, people want that quick win. They want switch LinkedIn ads on a Monday, and by Friday you've closed your first deal. And it's just not necessarily realistic. And I think I've always said, exactly the same as you, they're 3 months minimum. And in that 3 months, you would have done some optimization, you would have done some, testing, and you would have found, I guess, your positive signals in those ads that you can carry forward. And then in the 3 to 6 months, you start to get those inbound and start to get that, like you said, you start to reach that opportune mass where the content basically just feeds itself. But yeah, 3 to 6 months for sure.
Yep. So you mentioned in the current environment, of course, we're all struggling with.
I jump so like the lights up. Just gone off. Yeah. I'm the only one in the office, so.
We're obviously under a bit of a crunch, more pressure than the industry's been in a long time, with a lot of pressure to demonstrate ROI and effectiveness of campaigns. With that sort of lead time and uncertainty around content, what advice do you have, or strategies that you would suggest for how do you actually have these conversations with your manager, your C-suite, your investors, your board on, like, hey, we need to do this, but it's going to be 3 to 6 months with no guarantees before you're going to see anything out of it.
I think data is king. So, I mean, personally, internally, we track, I couldn't even tell you how many different metrics, and I sort of reference them as positive signals there, but it's anything that suggests you're moving in the right direction. And I appreciate, obviously, in the short term, you're going to want some quick wins, but I think the quick wins come more from the capturing the existing demand. You've got a solid website, the user experience is great, the product messaging's bang on, you've got a good way for booking demos, or you've got a nice inbound process already in existence where you're able to capture that existing demand, when the market is down, for example. And then obviously long term, you're investing in fueling that, capturing the demand by creating the demand, which takes more time. But I think as long as you can show those positive skills that are positive signals, sorry, that are all pointing in the right direction, month on month, you're getting 10-50% growth in organic visitors to the website. You're getting 5% growth on your LinkedIn followers, whatever it is, every single month, then at least in the short term, you've got some sort of, value that you can show internally.
100%. So you've used the word content engine a couple of times. Can you unpack what's behind that? What does it actually entail to have a content engine, and how do you go about building that?
Okay, so I think from our perspective, building a content engine, I think you've got the structure of it, and then the ultimate goal of it. I think the goal for us is essentially to create an owned audience. What I mean by an owned audience is people who are subscribed, right? They are newsletter subscribers, YouTube subscribers, LinkedIn followers, podcaster followers. They come back and check on your blog every time you send them an email. And I think the goal for us is to build content that provides value, education, upskilling people so that they keep coming back for more and they subscribe, which, as you said, ultimately over time, you're building up that mass of subscribed followers, engaged users, and it's going to cost you less and less to retain them. Obviously, as you grow and scale, the speed at which that you're getting those subscribers and followers is naturally going to increase. So the content engine for us is purely targeted at leveraging those owned media channels, treating ourselves like a media house rather than a old stuffy B2B company. A B2B you know, a media house. I guess what I mean by that is people rely on us as a source of consistent, repeated, you know, quality information that they keep coming back for, in the same way that they might do a traditional media house. So I guess that's our main focus in terms of, you know, the goal of that content engine. And then I think there's some key parts to that content engine for us. I think SMEs internally is a massive thing. So, you know, most companies will have a sales team, a customer success team, people who have worked in the staffing industry, for example, which are three of our core markets. So we rely on those SMEs and we lean on those SMEs internally to help us produce that valuable content. Quality, so it's massive. So we don't share something, I think you touched on it earlier, unless it's valuable to our ICP and unless it, you know, can be distributed across multiple channels. The consistency of it and the point of view, I think, is another one. We always want to have a point of view. Our point of view is, you know, based around sales triggers, obviously, for Selligence, in that, you know, we believe sales triggers are the future. That pre-intent is the future. It's more optimal, it's more efficient, you get high outbound success rates. So that is our point of view. So quality, consistency, point of view, and owned media or owned subscriber channels are probably, you know, big parts of our content engine or content strategy.
Awesome. Sorry. So you mean actually focusing on value add helps? As opposed to
yeah, no, 100%. I think it's a lot easier to persuade someone to subscribe and keep coming back for more if it's useful to them, right? If you're just trying to peddle something, then people are going to switch off straight away. I think when you see posts on LinkedIn, if someone's saying check out our new product release, you know, XYZ, or here's something that will save you 3 hours of time and it's for free. You know, people want that sort of media. And I think we're producing the content anyway. And in all honesty, it would be a hell of a lot more time consuming, cumbersome, annoying, frustrating, whatever you want to call it, to gate it, to produce all of the sequences that, or automated sequences that follow up. So it's actually a lot easier to produce great content, which, you know, that should be where your focus is, and then just put it online and distribute it as well as you can without then asking for more off the back of it and having to manage all of that follow-up process after it. If you do that consistently and at scale, people will come to you. You won't have to go out and actively look for them.
Yep. Could not agree more. It's always one of my favorite things. Whenever I, you know, I'm trying to do somebody a solid or help them out and they're like, hey, I need, you know, can somebody take a look at our content strategy? It's like, we've been posting like regularly for X amount of time and like nothing's happening. Like you go look at it. It's like, well, all your content is like thinly veiled sales pitches. If there's any veil at all, it's like, well, maybe you should actually focus on some value add there. But that raises sort of the next question within that. How do you select or figure out what topics or what to write on from a value add standpoint?
That's purely dependent on your ICP. So I'll take Selligence as an example. Our core ICP is sales. So we have sales guys that speak to our ICP every single day. So that's probably, I sit, so just behind my monitor would be where sales would sit. And I then, to my right, I've got CS. So I've got sales and CS feeding back to me constantly. I hear them on the phone. I ask them, I'm very, very nosy. What are people talking about? What are people struggling with? Like, at the minute, it's, you know, the market's downsizing, people need leads, people are struggling with their outbounds, you know, response rates are down, you know, demo turnover rates are down, people just need more leads and higher quality leads to fuel it. So we try and position our content as much as we can based on the pain points of our ICP and how, you know, very, very like a sprinkle of how we can directly help support that. But the main goal is just how we can help, how we can upskill the pain points of our ICP.
That's awesome. That's always been one of the most effective strategies I've had when I was running marketing teams, is making sure I've got tight alignment and two-way communication with the sales team. And it's always mind-boggling to me, the number of marketers that I talk to, and it's like they never talk to anybody on the sales team. Or if they do, it's, to point fingers and say, hey, you're dropping the ball on the leads we're generating. And they're saying, you're generating terrible leads. But, there's not ever actually that two-way communication, which, of course, is a challenge in some orgs, because you've got to build that alignment, especially if it's, not been done traditionally. Obviously you're in really close physical proximity to them. Any strategies or things that you can share around how to drive that, especially if you're remote, not in the same place, you can't leverage actual physical proximity?
Yeah, I think I've worked personally at some, I would call them like legacy B2B companies in the UK. So companies that are like an 8 billion valuation, and they've got thousands of staff and, 100 marketers and however many thousand salespeople. And I think the difference between that sort of structure and the structure we're in now is just, it's that one team, which sounds like a real cliche, but like you're not marketing and you're sales. You are a revenue generating function. Both of you are there to generate revenue. So we have, just to give a couple of examples, we have a monthly town hall where marketing have to present, sales have to present, and they all support that same strategic goal and the same revenue goal. So all of our information that is filtered down into the teams is aligned to the same goal. There's a sales meeting every month that I have to present that from marketing. This is what we are doing for you to try and help generate those inbounds, to try and make your job easier. Here's the collateral we've done for you. Here's the changes to the website that's going to make your jobs easier. So it is very much a case of I am held accountable by sales. I hold sales accountable for any inbounds. I am very like when there's inbounds and they go across, I'm like, guys, what's happening with this? Is, good, bad, give me the feedback. And it is just that open communication and holding each other accountable. So monthly presentations, weekly catch-ups, whatever it is, you've just got to make sure that the communication is as good as possible.
That's awesome. And you've touched on and covered, the sort of anecdotal subjective feedback that you're able to generate from those teams. From the data side of things, what are things you guys pay particular attention to in order to, give some direction, level up, the content, the topics, things that you're focusing on?
I think for us, in terms of obviously, we have a view of things like conversion rates inside CRMs, taking into account the performance of or the uplifts from our tools. So we compare those sort of outbound success rates with the industry averages. We stay very on top of the industry averages in terms of, how many leads are converting to qualified opportunities, how many are the qualified opportunities, and then, are you closing? And we pay very, very close attention to those. Obviously, when we're on those calls, as part of the sales process, it's very much a case of, what is your average at the minute? How can we look to help that? How, what integrations do you have? And we have different data for each of the integrations that we have, different CRMs, et cetera. So we keep a very, very watchful eye on industry trends. So I think there was a one of the stats that we were sort of paying close attention to, is the number of dials it takes to connect to someone, or the number of dials it takes to have a genuine conversation with one of your ICP buyers. And that feeds into our ROI calculations, the number of people that you would expect to turn up to a demo. We reference that into our ROI calculations on our outbound success. So it again, it's very much a case of when we ask the question, almost as if it's like a industry survey, when we're speaking to customers. And it's very much two way. We share as much insight as we can, and we ask for as much insights as we can.
Yep. And what about for what you guys are generating internally? Are there specific signals that you're looking for, or things within the data to give you direction on, like, topic selection for your podcast and stuff?
So, I mean, in terms of, do you mean in terms of, I guess, deals, close won deals that we've had success with, and what was successful in that process? Like what messaging was resonated well?
Yeah, I mean, that side of it, but we were talking through, like, the sort of anecdotal subjective feedback from the sales team that you're doing such a great job of generating. But asking if there's anything on, the analytics number side that you use to help, shore up, support what you're hearing, sort of anecdotally or subjectively, to combine and give you, a firmer direction around things.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, in terms of that internal tracker that I've got for marketing, there's just to give a bit of background, there's a tab for website, LinkedIn, YouTube, podcast, every imaginable channel that we're basically pushing content out on, every imaginable channel that we can get data for, and we log that every single month, and then we compare that to the, like you said, those insights that we're getting from the sales team, and the insights might be, this went down very well, and we'll cross-check that against certain pages on the website, you know, certain content pieces. I think, you know, one of the content pieces that is doing really, really well for us at the minute actually talks about UK salaries being lower than the US and the UK, and then that content piece actually came off the back of a call from one of our staffing clients who said that there was one of the questions that they were asked most in their sort of field was that, and we produced a piece of content around it, and it literally is our best performing piece of content in terms of organic SEO every single month. So it's yeah, definitely a two-way street.
That's awesome. That's awesome. So we touched upon this sort of the started off. Selligence is generating pre-intent signals for customers, which of course entails somewhere around that journey after the pre-intent. So you need to get to an actual intent signal. And content for me has been one of the most effective ways to get there. But what type of intent signals are you guys internally, or your advice that you have for your customers to take that from like pre-intent to an actual intent signal?
I think I guess in terms of where we want to be and where we are two very different answers to that question. I think
That's fair.
we definitely a firm believer in self-reported attribution. So that's something that we introduced again, sort of Q2, Q3, on our inbounds. But we obviously pair that with data-backed analysis as well. So we've seen a really nice uplift in word of mouth referrals. LinkedIn started to creep in now, and obviously one of the sort of main goals of the podcast was that we start to see the podcast mentioned in self-reported attribution. As well. So there's a few key pages on the website that we track that would definitely show higher intent, like pricing page, ROI calculator page, those sorts of pages, demo pages, all of those different sort of layers of the journey. But, you know, we don't really look at as a website visit as as much of an intent, to be honest. Let's put it that way. Like someone visiting our website once isn't going to get a phone call from our sales team saying, do you want to buy? So, you know, there's definitely various levels of the intent that we're looking at throughout that funnel, if you want to call it that.
Yeah, it sounds very familiar. Anytime I get hit up by somebody saying like, "Hey, we need help with our lead scoring model," it's like, oh dear God, not that. Like, don't you know a email open's not worth a point and a link click's not worth three, and that's not going to give you a real intense signal. And what you talked about is actually the way that I've been doing it for a while, and I recommend most people, which is, create engineered intentional conversion points or thresholds as your intent signals instead of trying to like build some point scoring system with it. Like build stuff in there that pretty clearly indicates like, okay, they've gone past awareness and they're in sort of a middle of the funnel stuff. So, create content, create conversion points, whatever, around somebody that's at that stage that's interested at that point in it, or things like pricing, demo, trial, whatever, for bottom of the funnel, where they can clearly be raising their hand and saying like, hey, we're at this point in the journey. And then in each of those points, like make sure you've got built-in nudges and pathways established for how do they get from where they are there to the next place you want them to get to, and be intentional about trying to drive them there.
Yeah, like you said, those nudges, one of the simplest nudges, if you're running LinkedIn ads, is obviously you have your audience built on specific pages and time frames and things, and then you can chuck them into a retargeted to try and sort of move them further down that funnel. But I think the pricing page was a good example. We didn't have a pricing page on our website a few months back, and over the last few months it's en ended up generating some of the most number of page views of any page on the website, and we actually stuck a form on there because at this time we don't necessarily share the full pricing for our organizational sort of plan. So we had a pricing proposal request, and that ended up literally within the first few days of it going live, we started having pricing proposal requests, which was a whole new channel that we were that we opened up just by creating a page, which took us a couple of days really.
Yep. Anytime I'm talking to a company that doesn't have a pricing page, it's like, I don't care if you don't publish your pricing. You still need a pricing page. And it's like, that is, you know, if your most high intent prospects, I guarantee you will be Googling your company name, your product name, and pricing. It was like, you need a place for them to land. You need a way for them to reach out and have that conversation, even if you're not publishing it. And it's mind boggling. I mean, the number of people that are like, no, we don't want a pricing page. We don't need a pricing page. Like, yeah, you do. Like, yeah, get that up there now.
it's something we're still very actively working on in terms of that pricing page, because we are, you know, on a journey to moving towards, PLG with a freemium model as well. So that pricing page will become ever more important in terms of driving, right, free trial, start a professional organizational plan, and guiding them through that journey. I mean, the ROI calculator is a page that went live last week, and we're already seeing really good sort of, you know, submissions, I guess, to that form of people trying to find out what the potential ROI they're leaving on the table is. And again, like you said, it was just another way of trying to gauge different levels of intent. You know, they're probably going to look at an ROI calculator before they look at submitting anything or pricing, aren't they? So just trying to plug a few of those holes, really.
Yep, absolutely. ROI calculator is an excellent, in my experience, like middle of the funnel step or signal. Like, hey, we've got awareness. We're looking at solutions. Like, how would I actually get a return on this? Or how would I actually like pitch this or budget for it, whatever. So for a lot of companies that for a lot of companies that don't have, you know, anything like this running, or they're trying to figure out, like, all right, I'm sold, I need to do this, but I have no idea how to get from like standing start to actually having an engine. What's your advice on kind of where to start, what to prioritize, you know, essential things that you need to kind of get off the ground?
I think I'll give a bit of context in terms of, or a bit of background in terms of our team. So I'm a sole marketer, and I don't mean a sole marketer in my department. I mean, I am the only marketer for the business. So there is me as a sole marketer, and then we have two other colleagues who sit in the research team that do pitch in on content. So just to give a bit of background in terms of the headcount, which I think will give a bit of a better understanding in terms of how we structure in, you know, if you've got more people than that, then hopefully it should be easier, albeit too many cooks can sometimes spoil the broth, as they say. But we have a relatively simple cadence. I think for 2023, our target is to post twice a day on LinkedIn. That's just one of my own targets. Release one podcast episode a week, create two high quality written pieces per month, and send one newsletter per week. And that was based on just our resource in terms of time. Like, for us to produce a high quality content piece when we don't actually have a dedicated writer, we think, you know, two a month is a relatively good sort of cadence to follow. If we get 25 pieces, very high quality content over the course of the year, that's great. We use monday.com for the planning side of it, the operation side of it. We have a board inside there that each of us can obviously look at, work, edit, add comments. We have a weekly content catch up for the three of us, for us to discuss all new ideas and for anything upcoming. And then what we do is, like I said, we have that post-production to-do list. So for every piece of content, it's like a 20-25 step process that we have to go through for each of them. And that's how we just keep stuff moving through. We have a Teams channel, Slack, whatever you want to use, where we have a proofing channel, other areas of the business pitch in and add comments. So we basically keep ourselves accountable with a fairly rigid structure. I do like structure. I love Excel. I love things that can be given deadlines and timelines and anything like that. And I think you've got to keep yourself accountable. Like we said, that consistency is key. So if you agree a cadence at the start of the year, then try your best to maintain that cadence. and share the load as best you can. Like I said, I do all of the execution of the content, the distribution, as well as the podcast. I handle the podcast, and then the written pieces are handled by one of my colleagues, Becky, and another called Zara, who help with the written content. So that gives a bit of a background as to how we sort of maintain that engine and keep it moving forward. Obviously, there are lots of other moving parts that you can't necessarily control. You know, if you've got external sign off, for example, that's probably one of the biggest hurdles that you have to overcome. That can typically take anywhere from a few days to 2 weeks, 3 weeks sometimes, which can be frustrating. But yeah, that's a bit of a background.
Awesome. So yeah, I think that's really, really vital advice, is to start with what your internal resources are. What do you actually have, and then try and be reasonable with what your goals are relative to that. Also, you know, I think something you guys have done really well is, all right, we're going to focus primarily on this podcast piece. We're going to do all that we can to get extra mileage, repurpose, all of that stuff around what you guys are doing on the podcast. But it sounds like the podcast is really the focus of it, and really the thing that you guys are trying to drive. You know, you've got obviously the written content, a couple of pieces a month. But yeah, the big thing out of that is, and I see people do this all the time, don't try and do too much all at once. Like, get one piece of it, or, you know, part of it stood up, get it to that critical mass, get to where that flywheel's spinning, then try and layer on something else. But you know, focus on what you can do, focus on executing on that, doing that regularly and being really, really consistent with it. And then, and you know, that's the other piece that we had talked about, like, it takes time. So like, don't get 3 weeks into your content strategy and say like, well, we're not generating anything out of this, so let's go over here and do this. Like, God, what a recipe for disaster.
Yeah, I think a good example of that is Diary of a CEO. Everyone knows Diary of a CEO podcast, but I think it took something like between a year and 2 years. It was just flat. They didn't grow at all for a year or 2 years. And then it just, you know, hockey stick growth. It just went absolutely mad. And I think even Stephen Bartlett said, if you're going to do a podcast, you need to stick to it for a year or two before you'll see any, you know, measurable, demonstrable, whatever you want to call it, results. And I think, base it purely off your resource. I'd love to be on TikTok. I would love to be on Facebook and Instagram and all these other channels. We're a marketing team of one with two people who work in research who help a lot with the content, but that's still only, there's no dedicated resource for writing that content. And there's, try not to be grass is greener syndrome. There are marketing teams that produce very good quality content at scale, but there's 40 marketers in that team. Monday.com, I think I saw on LinkedIn, this was a very interesting one. It was like how Monday.com like absolutely owned SEO, and look at the organic growth they had, but they hired 15 content writers who each produced a certain number of content pieces a month, and it was ended up being like 1,000 content pieces over a year. And that drove, basically they just owned all like organic sort of, you know, media or content in that space. But how much did it cost for those 15 content writers, and how much did it cost for the marketers to promote the content and distribute the content? And I think it's, yeah, just be realistic for the resources that you have from the get-go.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it sounds a very similar story to HubSpot. You know, that was sort of the secret to HubSpot getting in the place they were. Like, they were, you know, as much as they were a technology company selling a MarTech product, they were also a just media company. You know, they were generating just so much content and driving so much traffic to their site and so many inbounds. Like, I had a conversation with one of their heads of growth at one point, and they were talking about like, we don't do demand gen. It was like, we have the contact information of every single prospect that we could sell to. Like, at some point they've come to the site, they filled out a form, like we touched them. And it was like, that's kind of insane to say. But yeah, I mean, they are, you know, they're right up there as one of the kings of, you know, how do you execute on that strategy? But, you know, absolutely to your point, part of how do you execute on that strategy is having enough resources to have a big enough team to create that much content.
Yeah. No, so, I there's, what are some of the, I was just going to say, if you type pretty much any marketing related question or query into Google, HubSpot are going to be ranked in the top 3 to 5 positions. And they have literally answered every single conceivable question people might have about how to do their job. And it's worked extremely well, but they were the first people to do that. So I think now everyone's trying to do it, which is why it's so, you know, difficult to rank.
Yep, absolutely. So for those companies that are not fortunate enough to have those kinds of resources, you know, any strategies that you can recommend, tips or tricks on how to do it on a shoestring, especially if they're running like a marketing department of one like you?
Yeah, you've got to think best bang for your buck. Honestly, the podcast is, in terms of just internally for ourselves, is best bang for a buck. So I think we use riverside.fm. which is about $29 a month. And we use that to record. The reason we use it is because you can quickly clip up into various different layouts and stuff for LinkedIn or for YouTube. So $29 a month for that. It costs us nothing to get people onto the podcast. It costs us nothing to post it on LinkedIn. The only other thing you would need is a piece of editing software if you wanted to do specific clips and things. I think, you know, again, you can use iMovie, you know, which is free. We're lucky enough to have an internal designer as well. And that designer has the Adobe suite. So we have Premiere Pro that we use. But aside from that, it really, the only cost associated with our podcast outside of paid advertising is $29 a month. Canva, again, is free. You know, we use Canva for basically everything to do with that. So the podcast is definitely the best bang for your buck. It's definitely labor intensive. But anything done on a shoestring is probably going to be overly labor intensive. But the results off the back of the podcast are fantastic.
Awesome. And yeah, you mentioned, you know, in a couple of places using internal resources, whether that was, you know, additional team members that can help carry the load on, you know, the creation of the content, you know, an internal designer that you have, you know, primarily sounds like for, you know, other use cases within it. But I think that's also critical is like, take a look at your team, take a look at what, you know, resources you have internally, what talent, what things that you have to lean on. A big piece of that is like spend a little time doing a little discovery, because you may find like you've got people that have talents or backgrounds and things that you weren't even aware of that you can leverage. And so, you know, it may, you know, at first glance be like, well, we got no help here. But if you take a few minutes and kind of talk through like, all right, these are our needs, this is where we're trying to go. Like, you know, what do we actually have internally?
Yeah, on you know, those monthly town halls I was on about, and those monthly presentations that that I give, or those monthly updates that I give, it was off the back of one of those actually that I think Rebecca, who is our research manager, but she's probably the main contributor in terms of written content, in terms of those high quality long form pieces, and it was off the back of one of those I think, and Becky touched base, and she said, "Oh well, actually, I've got a background in journalism," and I was like, you know. I was like, amazing, great journalism. I was like, fantastic. And then you start, like you said, you start opening up these other channels. And I would almost put I would bet my mortgage, my house, on the fact that you have probably got someone in your business with an English degree, whether that's English literature or English language. You've almost certainly got someone who has got a design-based degree. And all these people, they are typically looking for a creative outlet. And writing or designing is a creative outlet. So yeah, make friends with people, have coffee with people, you know, open up the conversations. I always say, if anyone wants to help or if anyone's got any great ideas, just come to me and, you know, we'll try our best to look at it and work with it and see what we can do.
Yep. As always, over communication solves a lot of things. And yeah, to your point, ironically, maybe not, best web dev that I've ever hired. I hired straight out of college as an English major. Just happened to like coding sites and playing around with, you know, web dev stuff on the side. And it was like, oh, you can do that. How'd you like to come work for us? And he's like, you mean I can do this hobby and get paid for it? It's like, yeah.
I think the key thing to remember is, you know, you're probably 18 in the UK when you go to university. 18-year-olds don't really know what, there's not many 18-year-olds that know what they want to do when they're 30 or 40. So the chances of someone doing a degree in English or maths or science and then going on to do something completely different is very, very high. So just because someone is, you know, a web dev or just because someone's a research manager or someone works in sales, it doesn't mean that they don't have a degree in English and they love writing poetry. Like, you just don't know, do you?
Yep, absolutely. It's funny. It was similar to advice I was giving my 14-year-old daughter the other day. She was all 14. She's all worked up about, like, oh, what am I going to study in college? And I don't know what I'm going to go and be or do. I was like, I don't care what you choose at what age. I can virtually guarantee you 5 years later, you're not going to be doing the same thing. So it was like, don't stress so much about it. Like, it's going to change.
Yeah, I mean, I did design. I did product design, and you know, I didn't go into design because I didn't like people saying, "I want you to design this, but it has to look like this." I was like, "Well, that's not design." So that's why I went into marketing, and I used design every single day. But people, you know, would wrongly assume that because I'm a marketer, I've never designed anything. I just run ads or you know stuff like that. So.
Yep, I totally get it. I'm ABD, all but dissertation for a doctorate in philosophy. And you'd be shocked how much I use that background in the business world. And actually I've seen that, you know, broader backgrounds that people have, more often than not, the more they can offer in as far as, you know, unique perspectives or ways to think through things and stuff like that. So I strongly, strongly value that sort of diverse background and having experiences outside of that core thing that you hired them for. But we're coming up on the end of the hour. Before we wrap up here, Jamie, tell the audience, how can they get in touch with you?
LinkedIn is probably your best bet. Just Jamie Pagan on LinkedIn. I think that's my profile URL. That's either that or my email, which I'm sure people can get in touch on the Rev Genius community, of course. But they're the three best bets.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, sounds good. Thank you so much for coming on, Jamie. This has been a fantastic topic. I love a lot of the advice that you have on here. And, sounds like you've got your work cut out for you, but, sounds like you're doing a hell of a job as a team of one right now. So hats off to you.
No, I appreciate it. Thank you for allowing me to come on. More than happy to do it again. It's been great chatting.
Awesome. Awesome. Let's do it. Thanks so much, Jamie. And thanks, everybody. We'll be back next week.